This is the No Dabba Podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening I'm joined by Dane Hillard, a web application developer and author of Practices of the Python Pro, coming soon from Manning. Thank you very much for taking time out of your evening, Dane.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
To start off, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, please?
Sure. Like you mentioned, I'm a web application developer, and what that kind of means on a daily basis is building web applications, as you might imagine. For me, that's mostly in Python and Django. And I'm also doing some front-end development in JavaScript, particularly Vue.js lately, with a little bit of React occasionally too. So,
from your bio, I think you wrote that you've also worked in some other languages like C# and Java, I think.
A little bit of that. I was also sort of a C++ person straight out of school. But I started with Python maybe 8 years ago, and I've kind of never looked back since then. Picked up JavaScript most recently, but yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the book, please.
Sure. The book is kind of meant to be an introduction to software principles, sort of general software principles that can apply to a variety of languages. But the examples are all in Python, and it's meant for a beginning developer, whether they're coming out of school or switching disciplines into software, or just want to use software to augment the field that they're in order to get a better understanding of how to develop larger applications and what sort of goes into a maintainable application that you can collaborate with others on.
And I imagine it's a labor of love, like most books.
Yeah. In my case, Manning approached me and said, "We've seen some of your writing, and, you know, if you would be interested in writing a book, let us know." And that was sort of the first moment I had really thought about doing something at that scale. But it sort of made sense. I mean, I enjoy writing. I enjoy teaching others. And it's also, as with most teaching, a way to learn yourself, right? Mm. So I felt like it was a good fit. I'll let you know later on if I was right. But
I was going to say, at the start, it sounds fantastic. You know, a publisher wants me to write a book.
Yeah.
How is it going for you?
It's going pretty well. I just kind of passed the halfway point, I guess. I don't know if that counts yet as the home stretch, but it's, you know, as you go through, I think you kind of find a rhythm with your writing and understand kind of the voice that you'd like to have, and you kind of hone in on your target audience a little bit better. So it ideally gets easier over time, but some of the later chapters also get bigger because you're building on what you're teaching. So it kind of ebbs and flows.
And for listeners, I'm going to give away, or Manning are going to give away, 3 copies of the book, and there'll be details on how to get them at the end of the podcast. But to come back to you, Dane, what you said that you've been writing about Python for some time, and you learned through writing yourself, but what do you write generally? Is it, let's say, for beginners, for intermediate, advanced?
A lot of what I've written is for the same audience that this book is, people who are newer to Python. But I think I also write occasionally on things I've learned myself recently, right? Things that are sort of fresh in my head, something that I was confused by and then learned how to overcome. So some of those are a little bit more advanced topics. With Django, for instance, a couple of the sort of lower level Django internals and how to deal with those, more than just at the surface level. So,
but when you have 8 years of experience in Python, how do you put yourself in the frame of mind or from the perspective of someone who's new to it and write in a way that's easy and clear for them?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know if I've done it. I'll have to ask around. But I guess when you write, you want to be able to put yourself, sort of imagine yourself knowing almost as little as possible about the subject. Maybe from a sort of base understanding, maybe I know Python, maybe I know some of the syntax, maybe I can write small little programs, but the goal is to kind of imagine sort of don't take anything for granted, right? You want to explain most things with some level of detail without being too. The risk is that you sound condescending, right, by over explaining something. So there's a bit of balance there. I don't think it's perfect every time, right? There are certainly times where you will over explain or maybe under explain something, but I think if you hit sort of the sweet spot, a reader can skip over some of the detail that they don't necessarily need. And then if they get far enough along and they're like, oh, I guess I didn't know as much about that, they can go back and read more about it. So
even though the book is about Python, the principles apply much more broadly because I've been looking through it. And what we're going to do for the rest of the podcast is follow the first section of the book, chapter by chapter. And the first one is about separation of concern. So why is that important and what does it mean?
Yeah, so in the few years that I've been developing these larger Python applications, my experience has been that the more behavior and the more features you build into an application, the harder it is to keep everything in your head, even at a high level. I work on a website where I can't even remember all the pages that are there, right? So for someone starting out or at any point in their career, really, I think one of the big wins you can have is to write applications that let you offload a lot of that mental load into the code itself, and make code that you can easily rediscover the behavior that's there by reading the code, and obviously maybe some documentation where necessary. But I think separation of concerns in particular, there's a number of things that means, a lot of which is making sure that code that does one thing is contained in some way from code that does another thing, right? So that's sort of the first step to me in making sure that you are able to distinguish some code from some other code that handle different operations. And so the first chapter about that kind of talks about the variety of ways you can do that in Python. And the importance of sort of offloading mental stress.
What are the features of, let's say, a language to provide that capability? And they don't just apply to Python again.
Yeah. These are language constructs like functions, methods, classes. And then other languages have different names for things that are at a higher level than that. But there are modules and packages and things like that. So the sort of most granular one is a function, right? So separating and naming functions well, that's still something I struggle with almost on a daily basis, right? So, it's a very good one to write about, especially because you realize how little you practice what you preach sometimes.
Now, naming can be quite difficult because it has to be clear, somewhat self-documenting, not same as something else. But what kind of general principles do you advise people to follow in your chapter or in the book, rather?
I think the biggest thing that I can say is that you should look at your existing code and sort of try to identify the things that it's doing. Try and look and give those different lines of code sort of a mental name in your head and understand, these lines are doing this. These lines are doing this. And if you can think of a name or even a short sentence to give that behavior, that's probably an opportunity to separate that concern.
Do you give any general advice on how long, let's say, a method or a function should be? You know, how many things a class should do?
I mean, in terms of length, I try not to be too prescriptive, right? There's some amount of necessary complexity to any given piece of something, and that may fit in one line or it may fit in five lines. I don't try to be too prescriptive there.
What about the 500 lines?
it's hard to, you know, you want to draw a line in the sand because there's a clear time when it just is much too much, right? But it's hard to draw that definitive line because, again, sometimes there's necessary complexity due to business needs and things like that. But in terms of separation of concerns into classes, it is a bit easier to say like one class should do one thing. The definition of thing sometimes changes, right? But there's sort of this idea of the single responsibility principle, right? So any given piece of code should have one duty. And if it has to change because of some other duty, that it needs to be separated out further.
One guideline, to go back to length of functions and methods that I've seen, is to have it something that fits into one screen on your IDE. So if that's 20 lines, that's generally probably about enough. One feature of C# that I quite like, a recent thing, is called local functions. So within a larger function, you can have a smaller function, and the smaller function can only be called from within that larger function. So it allows you to isolate out some code. It's a nice feature, and I find myself using it at times when with C# I could write a complicated lambda, or I could write a somewhat easier to read local function.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that metric of one screen before too, and I like that. It gives you at least an order of magnitude to work with, right? And Python has this same concept kind of local functions. I think people generally call them inner functions in Python, but you can have a function inside a function or even a class inside a class. It's an interesting way of separating things and encapsulating things. I haven't done a lot of that particular style myself, but it's used frequently for certain specific types of Python code.
In Python, do you see a lot of reuse of classes?
I guess it varies very much based on who's written the code or what the code intends to do in some cases. I think if you're using a framework like Django, for instance, it's built a lot on classes. And so using that style is a natural extension of the framework. The thing with Python is that it supports multiple paradigms, right? You can do object-oriented programming, you can do functional programming, you can do sort of declarative programming. And so some big applications mix a variety of those things in. It's not as, I wouldn't say it's as evangelical toward any particular paradigm as some other languages are. It seems like people use what fits the solution they're trying to give. So
I'll move us on to your next chapter again. We're following the path of the book. And I've worked in quite a few large companies, and I have failed to see anything like a use of an abstraction or an encapsulation in code. But before we get back to that, can you explain what they are for the listener?
Sure. So abstraction, again, is kind of a tool for offloading some mental load, right? You want to be able to treat a certain set of ideas or concepts or behaviors at a high level instead of having to deal with all the details of what's actually going on under the hood. So abstraction is a way to think about that and a way to actually implement that in the code. And the tools for that are similar to separation of concerns, right? You have functions, classes, methods, and namespacing. And so I guess abstraction is that idea of, you know, if you think about abstract art, it's not got a real, it's often made fun of actually, but it sometimes lacks form or any particular idea. And when you sort of apply that to code, it might be a stretch to make the allegory, but it's this idea that you don't have to know the very specific details of what's happening. You can talk about it at a high level.
Could you give an example? Something that you've done recently, for example?
Yeah, I mean, an easy example is this model view controller structure, I guess, that a lot of web applications or desktop applications use. So the model and the view and the controller are layers of abstraction. And in other wording, there's like the persistence layer, business logic, and the presentation layer. And each of those has a number of details. The persistence layer needs to know how to talk to a database. The business logic is where, you know, most of the code dealing with whatever field you're in lives. And then the presentation layer knows how to structure things as HTML or, you know, native macOS components, maybe, in order to show data to a user. So, you know, each of those has a ton of detail underneath it, but they've been abstracted as these layers that each talk to each other. And then as you have interest or need to understand one further, you can kind of go down that particular path without having to worry about the others.
And then the other half of the title of your chapter is encapsulation.
Right. So encapsulation is this idea of extracting a set of behaviors into a class, it doesn't always have to be a class, I suppose, but typically talked about as extracting these set of behaviors and information into a class that has high relation between all of those behaviors. Cohesion is the phrase I use in the book, right? So things that are enough related that they seem like they should live in the same space. I sort of present encapsulation as another tool for abstraction too, because as you separate concerns into classes, those are abstractions that allow you to sort of offload that particular class's behavior.
Can you think of, let's say, a bad example of encapsulation that you've seen, and what would be the correct way?
That's a good question. I guess in my experience, a lot of the times where I saw something that I wanted to fix, it wasn't necessarily that it shouldn't have been encapsulated, right? Or, there are times, I guess, where the opposite is true, where something's not encapsulated that feels like it should be. So a common case I've run into is that there are different behaviors that seem like they are related, but they live in different modules or very different parts of the code base, right? And sort of taking them, pulling them out of those respective modules and encapsulating them into an object that can then be reused throughout the code base is one way I've improved that. So,
would another possible example be something like, I'd say, updating a person in one part of your code, but creating a person and saving it in a different part of your code? Would that be bad encapsulation because I've split them into two different areas?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's often sort of case by case, right? But with sort of that short description, right, duplication can often be a signal that something encapsulated better or differently. The idea of encapsulation being that there's sort of one true source for how you do a particular activity. And so you know, if you have a pretty fleshed out full way of dealing with a user in one place and a full fleshed out way of dealing with a user in another place, those likely may want to come back together at some point.
Do you see in your professional work an absence of these fundamentals, you know, abstraction, encapsulation, separation of concerns as a common thing?
I don't know that I see a strong lack of it everywhere, right? It's a lot of these things are things I constantly think about and try to learn more about and get better at, right? So it's a constant process, certainly. And I think if you look historically, the general opinion has probably swayed back and forth on any particular subject a little bit. But I think sort of given the audience of the book who may not have experience with this particular set of ideas or may not have experience with software development per se at all, I think that there is sort of a important set of things to understand that may help you get to that day-to-day level where you can think about all of these things and balance all of these concepts as you write code. Because it's a lot to keep straight, you know.
Oh, absolutely. But let's say we've gotten to that point where we're good at understanding those things, and we've written our application, and it's not performing to the degree we want. What would we do to improve its performance?
Yeah. So, the book makes a strong point, I think, about first making sure that the functionality is correct, right, and then making the code understandable and readable. And that's where sort of those chapters leave off, right, with encapsulation, abstraction, separation of concerns. So at that point, hopefully you can take a look at your code and understand what's going on at any given level. And then from there, the sort of make it fast is the next step. And so that chapter in the book talks a bit about sort of simple concepts that you would use to get some extra performance out of Python, some language constructs that it has, as well as sort of general things to keep in mind. But then it also talks about profiling tools. So being able to sort of use a data-driven approach to understand where your application is slow, and being able to identify those exact spots that are pain points, rather than just sort of feeling it out. I think it's important to, you know, you only have so much time as a developer, so being able to make sure you're investing your time making the right thing fast is important. So it talks about CPU profiling, talks about timing. There's a module in Python that allows you to time your code, so you can sort of make quick changes and see if they really give you the gain that you think you're getting.
Yeah, C Sharp has very similar features, and there's plenty of profiling tools as well, like .trace, .memory. There's a few more ones I know that are free. But when would you say is the time to start measuring? Because, you know, there's always an argument of, you know, premature optimization is a bad idea. But on the other side of it, I've had Ben Watson, a Microsoft engineer who's written a book on highperformance.net. His argument along with that, though, is always measure. So it's kind of don't worry about it till you have to, but you should always measure at the same time.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like I said, I like to take a data-driven approach to it for sure. So I guess over time, you sort of begin to pick up different tricks of the trade, if you will. And you can kind of get a sense as you're writing some code, like, oh, this might not be as performant as I want. I'm going to write it this way for the moment. And come back and see what I can do with it later. So there is this point, I think, that you reach where you do constantly have that in your head. And if you know the tools for profiling and things like that, you can use them sort of as frequently as you like along the way. And I think there's a risk, right, that you develop an entire service or something that turns out to have been built sort of on the wrong foundation. And you find that out at the end that it's not performant, and that wouldn't be great. So there's an earlier point than the end where it's good to start profiling things. But I do think it's certainly important to kind of figure out what you're trying to solve first, and maybe even write a little bit of code first to get a handle on things, and then start incorporating these tools and the data-driven approach as you get more comfortable.
I think something a lot of us also forget about is when we incorporate third-party libraries in the world of C#, it's probably true in NuGet package, we assume that those things perform well, but it isn't necessarily the case. So
yeah,
there's
absolutely
a very strong argument to do an analysis before, an analysis after. And I have on occasion gone off to GitHub to download, to clone the repo. And rather than having a package reference to that code, I would have a direct project reference so I could, with breakpoints, step through it, examine it, see what it's doing. Because that, you know, if that's doing 10% of the work for you, that could be a huge, I could have a huge implication on your performance.
Yeah, that's a really great point. And I think especially, I don't want to sort of hammer on a particular language too badly, but the JavaScript community is kind of one of the more egregious examples where you just readily install packages that do something that you like to do. And I think some projects end up with something like tens of thousands of dependencies, right? Maybe several, like nested dependencies, but it's still, you know, you don't have a lot of insight into what those things might be doing. So that's a great point.
Yeah, it is odd how trusting we are at this point of code that's out there. And as you say, the package that I download depends on these 10 other packages, which depend on these other ones. Mm-hmm. You know, we saw it years ago with Heartbleed, you know, a very common library had a bug. Mm-hmm. Even though it was open source, and you know, this idea that, well, there's so many eyeballs on it, any problem will be noticed. We know that's not the case. There are so many projects, I'm going off on a little tangent, but there are so many projects out there in the .NET world that are a one-man show. Mm-hmm. If that person were to give up or to die or lose interest, that'd be the end of it. Mm-hmm. And there wouldn't be someone to take it over.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is the... And I guess that single person, that problem manifests in other ways too, right? That person experiences burnout more quickly. There's no one to bounce ideas off of. It's tough. And I think open source is starting to have a little bit more open communication channel about these kinds of problems now, which is great. But I think it's certainly got a long way to go before empathy and better processes and systems really sort of hit full force. So yeah, that's a great point too.
I'll bring us back to your book though, and the next chapter in this section is about testing. So what ways do you suggest people test their code?
Yeah, I certainly make mention there of test-driven development, and that's something I try to do, but I'm not as good at it as other people I know. But the chapter doesn't make too much of a determination, I guess, on doing test first or test after or any of that. It more talks about the reasons why testing is even important, and some of the tools that the Python community has for doing that. So it talks about sort of the anatomy of functional testing, right? Being able to set up preconditions for a particular situation, executing that situation, and then asserting that some postconditions are true. And I think that I never, I guess, learned about testing in school or in any sort of formal way. So if I had someone teach me about testing, I would have liked to kind of learn it that way, understanding why to structure a test a certain way and how to actually test your code from a philosophical standpoint, I guess. So there's quite a bit that discusses that. And then it talks about the unit test library and the PyTest package that are available in Python. So
unit tests are one type of testing. Mm-hmm. But how can you explain how that's different, let's say, from integration testing?
Sure. So unit testing is kind of founded on this idea of testing a unit, of course, but unit is kind of a piece of code that is small enough that you can isolate it and sort of verify all the behaviors that it presents as its public API. Whereas integration testing may take multiple or even many of those units and execute a code path that involves all of them and assert that something way at the very end happened or is true as a result of executing that larger path. So unit tests test one small piece. Integration tests make sure that all those small pieces are working together in unison.
Another thing I've generally found is that unit tests tend not to have any external dependencies, like say a database or something of that nature. Instead, I would mock a database or use an in-memory database. Whereas an integration test would have the real database that I might create, seed, and then at the end of it, tear it down, get rid of it so it's not left around. But it's the real database as opposed to an in-memory one.
Yep, that's a great point. And the chapter that's about to come out for this book too talks about flexibility and things like inversion of control that really allow you to mock those dependencies or inject those dependencies at testing time so that you can get rid of those so-called real dependencies or external dependencies. It helps you speed up your tests. It helps you make your tests simpler. So that's a very helpful approach.
That's an interesting one, though. In the C-sharp world, you would, for mocking and dependency injection, you generally want to have an interface. But I think you said to me as we were prepping for this, in Python, there are no interfaces?
Yeah, that's right. So there's no sort of first-class citizen, if you will, that is an interface. And there are a number of ways to treat things like an interface in Python, but the biggest thing that sort of the reason interfaces don't exist in Python is because it's a duck type language, right? So the language is sort of founded on this idea that if an object looks a certain way and has the right methods and information that you want, why not treat it like whatever object you think it might be? So in a way that is an interface. Unfortunately though, it doesn't require you or it doesn't impose on you that a particular class implement this specific set of methods. There is this abstract base class concept in Python, so that gets you some of that, but that's still sort of on the inheritance side of things. So yeah, it's an interesting difference between a lot of other languages.
Another important part of testing that I found is the, I don't know, whatever you call it, performance testing or load testing. How much of that do you recommend people do?
More than I do myself. We do a number of those kind of tests, but they're not, at least for us, for our team, we don't generally have a lot of automation around those. I've seen some great talks where people are automating those things and they actually can measure the difference between their latest build and the previous build also automatically, right? And then for any given deployment, they can say, whoa, I increased my CPU usage by 13%. That's probably not good because all I did was some small change, right? So that would be an awesome place to be, but I do think it requires this strong investment in that kind of from the ground up, and making sure that that tooling works for your infrastructure and your sort of ecosystem, right?
Yeah, you are kind of touching on the idea of a pipeline for compiling, testing, performance, analysis, and then rejection and the like. And as it happens, this performance testing is where my C# world meets your Python, because I use Locust for performance testing, and I found it to be an excellent, excellent tool. Have you used it much?
Yeah, I've used Locust a little bit, and I've also used JMeter. So
I found Locust to be significantly easier to work with than JMeter, because with JMeter, a lot of it's around XML configuration, and it's to my knowledge, my laptop running JMeter is all one can do. Whereas with Locust, I can spin up 100 instances of it and have all of them communicating back to a master to aggregate those results for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's a simple Python script to make requests.
Yeah. In Locust, can you, I know with JMeter, what we've done in some cases is pull down access logs from our production application and then use them as sort of a template, if you will, for JMeter to get sort of a facsimile of how our production traffic actually looks. Do you know if that's something you can do with Locust?
I don't. I'm unaware. But for me, the big difference was the ability to scale my Locust cluster out.
Absolutely.
I will move us on, though, to our final topic, and it's security. So I've had a bunch of people, security people, on the podcast in the past. And I'm going to, you know, throw you a softball question here. And do you advocate building security in from the start or adding it towards the end of an application development cycle?
Yeah, that's a good one. I guess for me, sort of historically, certainly I've done it more toward the end, partly because of my own sort of ignorance of all the different vulnerability vectors an application can have, especially with the web, right? Building web applications, there's a lot of things that can go wrong. A lot of companies are having these data breaches and things, often through very sort of several levels removed from where that information was actually stored. An attacker gets in from way over there and then is able to make it all the way down to their sort of sensitive application. So for me, it has been a practice of putting things on later as I learn about them. But sort of like from a future me who knows all of these things, I would hope that similar to sort of performance tuning and measurement, that you can incorporate a lot of that stuff as you go. But certainly it presents complexities for testing and development itself. So being able to add those things into your application in a way that you can turn them off or have a sort of simple way of working on them in a development environment while still making sure that they're always on in the production environment, right?
Yeah.
Would be a way to go.
A concrete example of what you're describing I'm facing, where I've got an API that requires a JOT, and I have to get that JOT from an OpenID Connect 2 server. But that then means for my basic simple testing on my own laptop, I have to first make a request with Fiddler or Postman to get that JOT. Then I have to take that JOT and add it into all of the requests to the API that I'm writing. Now, the argument could be made I should automate that, but you know, I'm in the process of even figuring out what the API should do. So to your point, a good thing is to have a feature switch where you turn those off in development. But of course, you have to remember to turn them on later.
Yeah. We face some similar challenges in our authentication path because we're in sort of a microservice-oriented architecture, and we aren't running all of those services ourselves when we're running locally, because we don't want to replicate the entire world. And yeah, I mean, it presents challenges for sure. But I think that, yeah, the important thing, I would guess, prefer to err on the side of make sure they're always enabled in production, right?
True.
Yeah.
Dane, any final notes before we wrap up for the evening?
I don't know. I guess I'll say if you're looking to learn some software development skills in Python or maybe even other languages, and want a gentle what I hope is a gentle introduction to these concepts, definitely consider checking out the book. And I'd love if you connect with me too. I'm Easy as Python on Twitter, and my sort of portfolio website is dane.engineering, so feel free to reach out.
I'll put links in for all of those into the show notes. Well, Dane Hillard, thank you very much for your time this evening.
Yeah, thank you, Brian. It's been a pleasure.
If you'd like to be in with a chance to win a copy of Dane's book, leave a comment on the blog post associated with this podcast. If you like this episode, you might also like episode 113 with Morgan Bruce on working with microservices, or episode 108 with Mark Rendell on gathering metrics in .NET Core, or episode 95 with Ben Watson on high-performance.NET programming. The opening music was a return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Remember Trees by Chris Zabrinsky from the album Music from Neptune.